Hello, good afternoon everyone, and welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Series on Suicide and Safety Planning. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel Series, including a recording of today's session, can be found on our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. We appreciate your feedback, so if you can please fill out our feedback form, which is on the table in front of you, or if you're over the phone or via telehealth, it should have been emailed to you. So for those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving British Columbia children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to family and youth, as well as people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can visit our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca for more information, resources, and for our contact information. Now, for those of you that are in TV land that are joining us via telehealth, if you have problems with your telehealth during the session, you can just call your local telehealth support or PHSA telehealth support at 604-875-2000, extension 6492. Okay, so before I invite our speakers to take the floor, I'd like to ask everyone in the room to please mute your cell phones if you haven't already. And everyone over the phone, if you can please mute your phones either directly or you can press *9 on your phone to mute you as well. This will minimize background noise and make the listening experience more enjoyable for everyone. Okay, so let's get started. Our first speaker is Dr. Tyler Black. Dr. Black completed his Bachelor of Science with honors in pharmacology at the University of Alberta in 1999 and completed medical school at the same university in 2003. He completed residency training in psychiatry at Dalhousie University and the University of British Columbia in 2008 and completed his child and adolescent psychiatry subspecialty that same year. He works primarily at BC Children's Hospital on the Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Emergency Unit, where he is currently the clinical head. He is also a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Black's primary research and clinical interests include emergency psychiatry, suicidology, violence in video games, and cross-cultural psychiatry. We're thrilled to have him here, so take it away, Dr. Black.
Thank you for having me. So I'm very sensitive to the back of my head being misplayed. I'm getting older, and so there's a bald spot. I'm going to try and position myself here. It's really nice to speak to everybody here. And normally when I give talks on suicide, you know, it's like a formal lecture. There's PowerPoint slides and things like that. But I've been asked to talk a little bit more sort of globally about suicide. And so I wanted to go over just dispelling myths about suicide and going over some realities of suicide. Just for everyone in the room to be aware, talking about suicide is a sensitive subject. There's people here who've experienced suicide. There's people here who've had suicidal thinking. And any time a conversation like this stirs up feelings, it's important to know what resources are available. So during this conversation or any other concerns about conversations about suicide, know that there are emergency resources out there for youth, such as youthinbc.com, even calling 911 or Kids Help Phone. For parents, there's organizations like SAFER and things like this. And it's just always important that these conversations can trigger thoughts, both negative and positive. I'm a suicidologist in my interest, which is a really odd specialty to have. People often say, is it really depressing? And it's kind of the opposite, because one of the reasons I became a doctor is because I actually really wanted to save lives. Actually, I wanted to be Eric Benton from ER. I don't know if you remember. He was the guy that did the fist pump on the credits, and I really wanted to do that fist pump. I've never done it yet. But I also wanted to save lives. And suicide is huge. So I always put it into this perspective of, in children, if you were to take all of the illnesses that kill kids, all respiratory illnesses, all infectious illnesses, all lung disorders, all heart disorders, if you all cancers, added them up, there would still be more deaths by suicide every year in children. So preventing suicide would be the equivalent of curing all cancer, lung disease, heart disease, and infections that kill kids. And so this is an amazingly huge number, that when you first hear about it, and then I counter it with, suicide is also a very rare event. It happens, but it happens in a frequency of children at about 4 per 100,000 per year. So what we're trying to do is figure out, who can we target, how can we get to them, what do we need to do to make the world a safer place for a very small percentage of kids? Because the good news is, most children are healthy. So even though cancer is number 4 and suicide is number 2 for kids, most kids don't die. Most kids live. And suicide is a very rare event. And so both being the second most common cause of death, behind number 1 being
accidents.
So accidents, which are preventable, and suicides, which are preventable, and then all these other disorders that are treatable that we spend so much time and energy focusing energy, dollars, research on, but we have accidents and suicides that are number 1 and 2, clear and well away from the rest of the pack. So suicide prevention and suicide awareness is something that I think is tremendous, balanced by the fact of how rare it is. So people get trapped in this feeling that they have to predict suicide. Now, I am literally a suicidologist. I can stand loud and clear and say, I am an expert on suicide. I cannot predict suicide. I can't do it. I don't expect anybody in the room to do it. I don't expect any organization or hospital to do it. We cannot predict suicide. We can assess suicide. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about the difference between the two. Knowing how rare it is, we have to have an understanding of what is normal for adolescents. So there's been really good research on adolescents and what's normal and what's abnormal. 40% of youth are sad more than 5 days in a row in any given year. 40% are sad. Not meeting the clinical criteria for depression, just on a survey question, have you ever been sad for more than 5 days in this year? 40% say yes. If you ask the question, have you ever had a suicidal thought? So not, I'm going to kill myself, or I want to kill myself. A thought like, life would be better off, you know, if I wasn't around, or I would be better off if I were dead, or just a passive suicidal thought. That number comes down to about 16%. But still, 16%. So 1 in 8-ish. If you ask a question like hopelessness, do you feel hopeless about the future? Kind of surprisingly, 22%. Extreme stress, do you feel so much stress that you feel like life is unmanageable? That question usually clocks in at around 20 to 30% of youth. Okay? So there is a high group of people who, if I heard hopeless, stressed, and thinking about suicide, am I worried about their suicide risk? Absolutely. Actually planning suicide, the number comes down to 4%. Actually attempting a serious attempt that could have resulted in death had it not been interrupted or treated, that goes down to 1.6%. Actually dying by suicide, 0.006%. Okay? So we are concerned about probably 16 to 18% of the population, and only a fraction of that population, 0.01% of the 0.1% of that population will die by suicide. So if we go in super stressed and super worried about every person and thinking that they're at risk and we have to do something immediately to fix the situation, we'll burn ourselves out. Because most of the people who come for assessment don't die by suicide. Most people with mental health problems don't die by suicide. Most people with stress and distress don't die by suicide. So we don't go in to suicide looking at it as, what are the risk factors that will make us treat something? We have to switch from trying to predict who that small group is to trying to do our best to treat all of them. So when I first talk about suicide prevention, I start looking at what we currently have. What suicide prevention strategies in the province are you currently aware of? What exists out there for people to prevent suicide?
Crisis lines.
That's a good one. What else exists out there?
Resources.
Yeah, there's resources, information.
Mental health first aid.
Mental health first aid, yeah. That's a little bit more on the prevention side, yeah. I like that one. CAPE unit, I work there. we exist. You know, when people are really in distress, they can get hospitalized. Most things that we classify as prevention are interventions. Mm-hmm. They are, someone has suicidal thinking, we want them to seek help, or we want help available to them. Prevention would be preventing suicidal thinking. And that requires to go upstream. So there's a great publication out by the McCreary Center, they do a survey of adolescent youth every 4 years. They ask 32,000 kids in BC, local, in BC. So every jurisdiction in BC, they ask them basic questions. The one that I'm always keyed on is, have you ever experienced so much distress, or so much stress that you feel like you're overwhelmed? Or do you ever feel so much despair that you feel like life is not worthwhile? Those are really extreme options. 12-year-olds, 4% and 6%, or 6% and 2%. 6% and 2% of 12-year-olds have so much despair that they wonder if life is not worth living, or so much stress that they feel overwhelmed and can't handle their problems. Tackling suicide prevention means treating youth distress. So identifying youth in distress early. Suicide is a downstream event from distress, mental illness, conflicts, situational crises, all these things. Suicidal thinking is the downstream effect. Prevention would be how to handle problems, how to solve things like child abuse, how to solve things like child mistreatment, overcrowding classrooms, non-personalized education as opposed to education that targets people and allows them to succeed. That would be true prevention. So whenever I'm talking to a group, I'm always talking, suicide prevention is a societal issue. It is not a medical issue. Suicide prevention is not up to doctors. Suicide prevention is not up to a hospital providing a great service. Suicide prevention is a societal issue. We are all responsible. When we vote with our tax dollars for funding schools, when we vote for things like community resources, these are things that directly could prevent suicide if they are deployed properly. So everybody here has a responsibility to prevent suicide. Suicide intervention strategies, such as crisis lines, require some way of figuring out what's going on. And I know Laura's going to be talking about ways, things to ask, or how to ask, or what would happen if you called, or those types of things. For the medical side of things, it's really important to recognize that what we do when we see people with suicide risk is we don't predict, we assess. I ask a bunch of questions. There are 480 known risk factors for suicide. Ranging from everything from how close you live to a power line, which is no risk. There's no risk living close to a power line. To working as an air traffic controller, there is a risk of suicide. So if I wanted to design a checklist knowing all of the risks for suicide, it would be about 75 pages long. It'd be very, very hard to sort out. So there is no checklist in the world that will adequately predict risk. What you can do is identify issues that are important for that person. So, for example, when I meet with someone, I'm seeing the emergency department, it matters that they took an overdose or that they had suicidal thinking, but I'm more interested in the distress that caused that thinking. I'm more interested in the family that's supporting them. I'm more interested in the medical services that they're receiving for their current medical issues. If I focused on whether or not they'll die by suicide, I myself would get distressed. It wouldn't help them at all. It would just cause distress in me. If I put that burden on myself to predict, then I'm just setting myself up for failure because I cannot predict. But what I can do is, tell me about your day to day. Tell me about the stresses that have been happening in your life. Tell me about what's been going on. And using that information to identify risk factors that I then want to treat. So say I feel the patient before me has a depression. If I treat their depression, their risk should come down because they now have a treated depression. they still have risk for suicide. I can't guarantee they're not going to die by suicide. I can't send them home saying, you are now safe, and you have been ordained by Dr. Tyler Black, a suicidologist, that you're no longer suicide. You're no longer suicidal. That's never going to happen. In fact, predictive-wise, the number one predictor of suicide is previous suicidal thinking. Forever. So they come and talk to me, and instantly they're at the highest risk category for the rest of their life. And I can't change that. What I can do is identify the factors that I can change. And so the big thing that I've instituted here at this hospital, and I want this to be out there in the world as well, is the way we document and think about suicide risk needs to be reflective of what are issues that we know about that we can't change. Age, sex, history of suicides, history of mental illness in the family, history of suicides in the family. These things, they're important. They inform the risk, but I can't change them. I could hospitalize someone with schizophrenia with a history of multiple suicide attempts, and everybody in their family died by suicide. What would their classification of risk be? Extremely high. What would their classification of risk be when they are discharged 2 years later? Extremely high. So there's nothing I can do for that. When I see that person, though, and they don't have a psychiatrist, or they're not responding to their medication, I can say, I can do this intervention. Maybe it requires hospitalization, and change the thing I can change and reduce the risk to the best of my ability. So I'm looking at reducing risk within whatever that person's baseline, unchangeable factors allow. So people often have this feeling like coming to hospital means you come with suicidal thinking and you leave with no risk of suicide. When in fact what we hope to have happen is someone comes with an unidentified series of risks and we modify what we can modify to the best of our abilities. But there will always be a societal component of everybody is at risk for suicide. And I don't want to get too graphic here, but if you are currently a prisoner of ISIS, you might consider suicide. Just throwing that out there. So everybody has a limit of stress and distress to which they may or may not consider suicide. So this idea that there's a group of people out there that are specifically targetable is a fallacy. We all have an interplay of risks and protective factors. Some people I meet with schizophrenia, a diagnosis of schizophrenia, have amazing protective factors that make me so unconcerned about their suicide risk that I don't feel they need any sort of treatment whatsoever. And other people with a mild illness that has very low relationship, such as anxiety, very low relationship to suicide, I'm very worried about their suicide risk because of how they cope with their anxiety. So it's not about identifying one disorder or one person. It's by looking at the patient in their entirety and the support system around them and modifying what you can modify. So when if I wanted to give sort of like a summary point of what I'm talking about, it would really be about the totality of suicide. When we think about suicide in general, we always think about the suicidal person. But there is stress, distress, coping strategies, support systems, and then somewhere down the road, someone gets suicidal. So I would really like everybody here to consider how society can support and prevent suicide, not what hospital do we have to develop, or what clinic do we have to develop, or what intervention do we have to plan, but how can we actually tackle the root causes, such as mental illness, such as youth mistreatment, such as marginalized societies. There's an Aboriginal problem that I haven't even discussed, such as Aboriginal suicide rates in rural areas. There are major societal issues that would prevent suicides and prevent deaths. And if we were to make a 25% reduction in suicides in children, it would be the equivalent of curing all cancers in children that kill kids. So this is not some, you know, hope we can do it. This is an actual targetable goal. We can actually save a lot of lives. The last part I'd just like, sort of myths I'd like to dispel, is that age is a risk factor for suicide. Suicide risk starts at around age 10. It increases to about age 24, and it continues lifelong. There is no time at life where you should not be worried about a patient you're seeing or someone around you. If you think that person could be suicidal or they're saying things that worry about you, there is no magic age to be. If a 10-year-old is talking to me about suicide, I'm concerned. If a 95-year-old is talking to me about suicide, I'm concerned. There's a lot of myths out there that adolescents are more at risk. Adolescents are actually less at risk, but it doesn't matter because when they're talking about suicide, I'm concerned. 45-year-old females are at higher risk than adolescent females for suicide. So there's a lot of myths out there. Another common myth that I'd really like to dispel is that suicide rates are increasing. Suicide rates are relatively stable. They are not currently increasing. They have not currently increased for about 20 years. And in fact, in youth in Canada, they're coming down by about 25% in the last decade. Most of it on the male side. Females is generally about the same. But in general, there's a pessimism about suicide that we're not doing anything. Right now, in the last 10 years of data that we currently have in Canada, suicide rates in youth are down by about 25%. So there is reason to be optimistic. It's just still a long way to go. So that's the part that I wanted to sort of talk about, and certainly happy to answer questions after that.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Black. So our next speaker is Laura Hamilton. She's the Child and Youth Suicide Clinician with the Child and Adolescents Response Team, or CRUST, at Vancouver Coastal Health in Vancouver. In her current role, she provides direct crisis response, assessment, and counseling to at-risk youth, as well as providing training and education about suicide and self-injury within the community of Vancouver. She is a registered social worker with a background in the fields of child welfare, education, trauma, and mental health. So welcome, Laura. Go ahead.
Thanks. So I guess to start, I'm going to also dispel one of the myths around suicide. I'm going to focus a bit on how you talk to a youth about suicide and also a bit about safety planning. But the first kind of myth I want to address is that perhaps we shouldn't be talking about suicide. I do hear this a lot. There's a lot of anxiety about maybe we shouldn't talk about suicide. If we talk to a youth about suicide, is this maybe giving them an idea they didn't have before? Is this suddenly going to give them permission to maybe act on their suicide thoughts when maybe they weren't going to before? The first thing to say about talking to a youth about suicide is that we should be talking to youth about suicide. It seems to be one of the remaining taboos out there in a way that people are very uncomfortable about, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Talking to anybody, and particularly youth, I think, about the idea that they may take their life, that provokes a lot of anxiety in us. The stakes are quite high when you enter into this conversation, and so I think often it's our own anxiety that can shut down that conversation and give us the idea that maybe we shouldn't talk about this. And also there's sometimes a lack of certainty about, okay, so if I ask a youth if they've been having thoughts of suicide and they say yes, well, now what do I do? And that anxiety can also sometimes block us from just having a conversation. And so the first place I want to start is just, we've got to ask, we've got to talk about this stuff. Kids are walking around with these thoughts, and like Dr. Black said, not everybody is walking around with these thoughts, but a lot of kids are. And they need to be able to talk about them so that they're not walking around alone. They know that there's stigma around the topic of suicide, and they actually can carry a lot of anxiety that if they tell an adult, then people are going to freak out, people are going to get scared, people are going to call the police, there's going to be big drama. And sometimes there needs to be that. But first and most importantly, kids need to know that they can talk about whatever thoughts of suicide they might be having, and that they can find an adult that is safe and comfortable and able to hear what they have to say. I just kind of want to start off with that. And I also want to acknowledge that sometimes we're not comfortable with it. Sometimes we do have anxiety. We all have our own histories and experiences and comfort levels and knowledge. So sometimes we're not the people that can necessarily be talking to youth about suicide because of the stuff it brings up in us. And that's okay. We don't have to be everybody. We don't have to be everything to everybody. But it's important that youth are able to find someone that they can talk to. So I just want to start by saying that it really is important that we be talking about this and that we talk about it directly and not dance around the topic. So what I want to do is just talk a bit about some of the questions that you can ask. It's important to recognize that, and again, Dr. Black pointed at this, that suicidal thoughts occur on a huge continuum. All the way from, you know, a teenager who's having a fight with their parent and yells out the statement, "Oh, I'm going to kill myself," but with no kind of thought around, other thoughts around that or other intent or anything other than just a flip off the cuff statement. I think most of us would agree that youth probably doesn't need to be rushed to the hospital in that moment. And then the continuum goes all the way to those small number of youth who really are seriously thinking about killing themselves and who have a plan and who are deeply distressed and at their last straw. And the only way to know where on that continuum a youth falls is to ask them questions, is to get information and get them talking about what their thoughts are, what their distress is, what their protective factors are. That's the only way we're going to know where a youth is in terms of their risk. So some of the things that you want to ask is, you know, first of all, have you had thoughts of suicide? And remember with that question, this isn't going to be out of left field. And I like to remind people of that, that whenever you're asking a youth if they've had thoughts of suicide, it's within a context of concern. Something about this kid is concerning to you. They're either they've made a statement already, or they're just seeming really down, or they're seeming really stressed, or they've had big stressors happen in their life. There's always a context for asking this question. You're not usually going to just, you know, walk up onto the football field of a school and, you know, take some kid aside who seems to be having a great afternoon and say, hey, have you been having thoughts about suicide? No, this is usually a conversation that you would have within a context. And it's okay to frame it that way, to say to a kid, you know, I've noticed lately that you've seemed really, really stressed out, and I know all these things are going on in your life, and you're withdrawing a bit from your friends, and whatever it is that you're noticing about a youth. And then say, sometimes I know that when people are feeling really overwhelmed and really stressed out, one of the things that can happen is you can go to a place where you think that suicide's your only way out. Have you been having any thoughts of suicide? And framing it that way not only is direct in asking the question, but it also reduces the stigma around it. It says, you know, you're having these thoughts not because you're insane, but because there's stuff going on in your life that is making you feel really overwhelmed and feel really hopeless. And yeah, in a sense, when we feel hopeless and we feel like there's no way out of a situation, our mind can go to that place. And so placing it in a context like that, I think, it destigmatizes it, it makes it a less stressful conversation for the youth, and it gives you kind of a platform to, a relational platform to have the conversation. So just some questions to ask, and I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. I tend to do larger workshops on these kinds of things, so this is just a brief primer, but you know, you want to ask questions like, how often do you think about suicide? On a scale of 1 to 10, what's the likelihood that you might actually act on your thoughts? There's a big difference between youth who say, no, I mean, I said that, and yeah, sometimes I have these thoughts, but I would never actually act on them, versus a youth that says, well, actually, I kind of don't know what to do. I think I could actually act on them. Do you have a plan? Again, there's a big kind of qualitative difference between youth who have just sort of vaguely thought that I don't know what to do, or I'm feeling really at the end of my rope, versus those kids who've thought enough about it that they've planned out, I think I might take an overdose, or I think I might try to hang myself, or whatever means. So that's another question that you want to explore, and if they have a plan, or do they have the means to sort of act on the plan that they might have in their head. Have you tried to kill yourself in the past, or have you tried to commit suicide in the past? This is a big question to ask, because like Dr. Black said, one of the most significant risk factors for a suicide attempt is a prior suicide attempt. And that's something we want to know about. If a youth has made a prior suicide attempt, then, and they're having thoughts of suicide now, we're going to be much more concerned about that youth than we might be about someone else. And does anyone else know about this? Is this something that they've talked about to someone else, either a teacher, a counselor, a parent, a friend? Have they posted about it online? Are they going to chat rooms? Is there someone else they've talked about? Does someone else know about it? Do they have any other supports in their life? That's something you want to know about. And also, you know, take the focus off the suicide thought for just a minute and really find out what's going on in this kid's life that is so distressing to them that they're thinking that they might go to a place of suicide. I really like what Dr. Black said about how we can't necessarily, not that we can't, but the better focus is to prevent the distress that leads to the suicide thoughts. And that's really what you want to find out about. What is the distress? What is so overwhelming in this youth's life? Because sometimes there are actually some small changes that we can make, either at school or at home or with friends, that can dramatically reduce the distress that a youth is feeling. So you want to know about that. And maybe one of the biggest questions that we're sometimes not as good at asking, because, you know, understandably, if we're actually having to talk to a youth about suicide, our anxiety is going up. There's usually protocol in place about things we need to do. Do we need to call the hospital? Do we need to call the police? Whatever. But And so we get really focused on that. But a really important question to ask youth is what's been keeping them alive? Just as important as what is so distressing that they might think about suicide, what is keeping them alive? And sometimes youth say nothing, but the fact is they've probably been going through their distress and their stress for a really long time, and they're still here. So something is keeping them alive. And getting them to talk about that a bit is in some ways just as important as finding out what the stressors are, because the things that are keeping them alive, that's actually what you're going to build on. That's what you're going to work with going forward. That's a very brief sort of overview of some of the questions that you might want to ask a youth who is thinking about suicide. And again, it may or may not be to anybody I'm speaking to here, it may or may not be you specifically that asks these questions. Sometimes either we don't have a relationship with a youth, or our role is such that it's not necessarily appropriate that we gather this information. In some ways, I'd argue that these are actually questions that anybody can ask to anybody. If you are out having coffee with a friend and they make some statement that makes you really concerned about them, I think it's okay to ask these questions to people, because, again, we need to reduce the stigma, and we need to kind of get rid of the idea that only certain people in certain situations with certain jobs are allowed to ask and talk to other people about suicide. It needs to be a topic that societally we're talking about more and more, and more comfortable just kind of putting on the table. The next piece that I want to talk about is safety planning. I know that's a component of what we're talking about today, and I want to say that I'm a really big proponent of safety plans with youth, of a certain type. So there used to be these things called no suicide contracts that people would use that would kind of get someone to sign a piece of paper promising that they're not going to kill themselves. That is not what I'm talking about when I talk about a safety plan. I'm not going to go into all the reasons why those are not useful, but what I will say is that safety plans, in the way that I speak about them, are things that are really proactive, that are really coping skills focused. So talking to youth about, these are the things going on in your life when you are distressed again, not if, but when, because they're going to be distressed again. They're going to feel overwhelmed, they're going to feel upset, they're going to feel angry, they're going to feel sad. When you feel these things again, what can you do to get over the hump? I also like to say, this is not a little safety plan, and I tend to write it with them on just a tiny little piece of paper. These are not things that are going to change your life necessarily. These are not things that are going to take all the stressors away. These are things that are going to make your stressful moments just a little more bearable so that you can get beyond them and reach out for help without hurting yourself. And I want them to be made by the youth. Sometimes youth, you know, have been, particularly youth who've kind of been around the system a lot of times, might roll their eyes a bit when you talk about safety plans, because, you know, they've been told that they're supposed to go for a walk or listen to music when they're upset. And that's fine if that's what works for them. But when I'm doing a safety plan with youth, I really want to get creative with them and find out what works for you. What will make you just feel a little bit better? And so there's a number of different items that I might put on the safety plan, and one is just that concrete thing of what small little things can you do to make yourself feel better. And it can be as basic as, do you have a favorite hoodie that you like to put on, and when you put it on and wrap yourself in it, you just feel a little bit soothed? Or is there a particular song that boosts your mood a bit? Is there a tea that you like to drink? It can be really concrete, because again, you're not transforming the youth's life with a safety plan. You're really saying, you're going to hit moments again where you're going to feel really overwhelmed. How can you get through that time to be able to reach out for help? And how can you get through the night? Or how can you get through the day? And very practical. These need to be things that kids can actually do. Sometimes safety plan items or coping skills ideas are not necessarily realistic. You know, if a youth lives in the downtown East Side, then going for a walk when they're feeling stressed, if it's 1 in the morning, because often youth are feeling really overwhelmed at midnight and 1 in the morning, that's not a realistic coping strategy. That's not necessarily a safe thing for them. So it needs to be things that they can do, that they will do, and that will work for them. And the second piece that I get youth to really think about is friends. Who can you reach out to? Who do you have in your life that is a friend? And I separate friends from adults. So think first about friends. Who do you have in your life that you can reach out to? And it doesn't even need to, I mean, kids don't necessarily even need to have friends that they can pour their heart out to and talk about all the personal stuff. if they have those friends, that's awesome. But a lot of youth don't. A lot of youth don't feel comfortable talking about this really personal stuff with other youth. But they often do have friends that they can message with and gossip with or talk about homework with or badmouth the teacher with, whatever it is. Just something to get them connected to another person and get their mind off whatever is distressing them. Again, the purpose of safety planning for me in these instances is to be really practical and giving youth the skills to get beyond the stress in the moment. So friends that they can talk to, and then adults that they can talk to. And I really like to talk to youth about the difference between peers versus adults in their life, and that peers are those people that kind of can relate to us and be in the muck with us, who might understand on a certain level what is going on for us, but they're not necessarily those people who are standing outside the muck and are able to reach down and pick them out. Those are the trusted adults. And unfortunately, a lot of youth don't have a lot of trusted adults in their life, but if they have even one, and it can be anybody. Sometimes it's parents, a lot of times it's not parents, but, you know, brainstorming with them, coaches, teachers, school counselors, mentors, anybody, any adult that can be that support person and kind of be outside the muck, is what I like to call it, who's outside the muck that can help them. And then crisis numbers. Crisis numbers are hugely important. Because sometimes youth are really kind of weirded out by the idea of calling a crisis number, because they think that's really weird to just call up some number and talk to a stranger about the stress that I'm going through. But the fact is, it's not the first thing youth are going to go to, and it's not meant to be the very first thing. If some of these other things are going to work for youth, then they don't necessarily need to call a crisis line. But the crisis lines are there when none of the rest of it works. They've tried to calm themselves down. They've tried to reach out to a friend. They don't have an adult that they can talk to, and they're still thinking, I'm going to hurt myself. That's what the crisis lines are there for. And I talk through that with youth. And one of the really great things, I know that this is true about the crisis line. If someone can correct me or let me know whether this is true about the kids' help phone, but I know for the crisis line, you can actually call them in the day. If you've got a youth that you're kind of safety planning with, you can call the crisis line and say, I've got a youth here, and I'm talking to them about calling a crisis line. They're not really sure about that. Would you mind talking to them for a moment and sort of go through what it would be like to call a crisis line? You can do those test calls with the crisis lines. And that's sometimes really helpful because it decreases the anxiety and makes youth more likely to call in the future. And then also letting them know about the chat room on youthinbc.com. Youthinbc.com is a fantastic website that has a chat room with counselors on it, which I think is great, because for those youth who don't necessarily pick up a phone to call someone, being able to get onto a computer and chat with a counselor is hugely helpful as well. And so having youth know these resources, and on a little, for those of you here, piece of paper this size. If it's something this size, I don't think it's as effective. As if it's something this size, it can fold up in their back pocket. They can carry it with them. They can have it as something. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm feeling really like gross or overwhelmed or whatever, my mind is not necessarily in a place of coping. My mind is in the place of wallowing sometimes. And that's what can happen. We lose sight of coping skills. And so if a youth can have it in their pocket and say, okay, these are some of the things that I can do, I think that goes a long way. I think that part of whatever role we're in, if we're working with youth, part of our role is to help them take more ownership of their own safety, because no matter what, we can't be with them 24/7 every day of the year. So the more that people, and this isn't just true for youth, this is true for adults, but the more that youth can really gain an understanding of what distresses them and how to get through those moments, I think that for me is really what a safety plan is all about. And I think that is where I will end for now, because I'm conscious of the time, so there you go.
Okay, thanks so much. Okay, so our next speaker is Jude Platzer. Jude is the director and founder of the Josh Platzer Society, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to educate British Columbia youth and those around them about prevention and awareness of suicide. Since her son's death 13 years ago, Jude has made it her life's work to educate others on prevention and awareness of suicide, with a particular focus on youth. She currently lives in Vancouver with her husband and 24-year-old daughter. And take it away, Jude.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, I have to start out by saying that Dr. Black and Laura stole a lot of my thunder, so either I'll cut it short or I might repeat myself, but anyway. I thought I changed it on the bio, but it was 16 years ago. It was 1999 that my son died. And we did know that he was depressed. He had made two attempts before. I have suffered from a history of depression and was suicidal in my teens. So I carry a little bit of guilt there, thinking that maybe I passed it on to him, but I'm told that's not necessarily the case. Anyway, the interesting thing is that people said to him, well, you know, what was wrong? I mean, we were not poor. He had tons of friends, together family. What was the problem? They couldn't see. He was diagnosed with bipolar. But people still say, you know, what was wrong with your son? Because people want to find a reason, you know, and mental health isn't always the reason that they like to hear. So I still get that. But what you both said was I think that the stigma has reduced quite a bit. I think, well, it's still there, of course, but I think we have really moved forward quite a bit. When my son died, He was seeing a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and after his first attempt, he came to Children's and they got him to see someone. When he died, we found in his backpack 3 full bottles of antidepressants, which of course he hadn't taken. Now we had asked the people at the mental health office where he went, should we make sure he's taking his pills? Oh no, they said he's 15, he's responsible, don't bug him with that. So we kind of backed off. He didn't take his pills, but he was very clever, and he'd say to me, oh Mum, I need more antidepressants. So he was not taking them, but he was making sure that we thought he was taking them. Right? One of the difficulties, I think, for parents with youth, and youth possibly at risk, is that teenage behavior is—it's difficult to differentiate whether this is a big issue or it's just a teenage behavior. For instance, he liked to have his room downstairs in the basement. Fine, it was always total chaos. I didn't mind that. But how many of you who are parents here and have had a teenager who lies on his bed with his earphones and with music going for hours? Very typical, right? Mm-hmm. So. We didn't really think that was a terrible thing, but now that I look back, maybe he did it a bit too much. You'd call him for dinner, he wouldn't come up for dinner. Lots of kids don't come up for dinner, right? Or they're on the phone or whatever. So what I'm saying here is that I think for worried parents, it's hard to differentiate whether this is normal adolescent behavior or that they should be really, really concerned. So after he died, of course, we were terribly angry. I was. And so somehow I went, first of all, to the Vancouver Foundation. We started a fund there, and then I soon realized that wasn't going to work. So we set about getting a charitable number, which took over a year. But anyway, we got that, and we started the society. And over the years, I would say we've done quite a few hundred presentations in the schools. That's Nancy knows me from those presentations. And we now have volunteer speakers who go out to the schools. The presentation, it's sort of changed over the years because it had a documentary, but it has a Walkman in it, and so I had to sort of explain to the kids what a Walkman was. And thought, oh, this documentary's not going to work anymore, you know, so... But in the documentary, it's about a family who lose a boy, and a lot of what you said about the myths and the repercussions and the guilt, it's all in that documentary and in the presentation. One thing I say to the kids, which I always remember, is that the way kids, and not just kids, adults too, treat people who they think might be depressed. I don't think they think they're suicidal. Well, they might, but they, you know, when they think they're depressed. So I say to them, well, Johnny comes in with a broken arm. He's fallen off his bicycle, and he's got a plaster. What do you call that over here?
A cast.
Yeah, a cast on his arm. So the kids will say, well, we'll say, you know, what happened, Johnny? How did you do that, you silly thing? Can I ride on your cast? And I say, so they get empathy, right? Sympathy. So then I say to them, well, how do you respond to a kid, a student who comes in kind of messy? They're usually not so messy, but they're kind of messy. And maybe they haven't had a bath for a couple of days, you know, a bit stinky. And they kind of hang their head and hide in the corner. How do you respond to them? Well, of course, the kid is giving out this negative vibe, and so other kids, unless they're really close to them, don't want to talk to them. So that kid is ill too, but because it's not a tangible thing, because we can't see the plaster cast on their arm, we don't feel the same way about them. We, in fact, sometimes you want to say to them, for goodness sake, I mean, I think people said that to my son, for goodness sake, why are you depressed? You've got so many friends, you've got this, he had it all, right? So why? I think when you show people how they react, and they probably don't even realize that they do that, it's a very different way of responding. So that's part of the stigma of mental illness, which we're trying to get through. Some of the things the society has done, you've talked about the crisis line and the number. We have orange bracelets. My son had red hair. My daughter wanted the bracelets to be orange. And they have the 1-800 suicide number, which I don't think we've talked about. That number goes right across BC and a little bit into Alberta, I believe.
1-800-SUICIDE actually works in every place in North America.
Mm-hmm. Ah, but
it's a different system.
Okay.
Like every province maps it to a different number, but 1-800-SUICIDE.
Oh, it's the 744-944, whatever that number is. Okay. I didn't know that. That's great, because the crisis center tried to get a 3-digit number, like a 511, mm-hmm.
yeah.
a while ago, and it went to the weather. I say no more. Some of you may have seen these up on the buses and around. We've done that poster campaign now for quite a few years, and I get quite a lot of good feedback about it. Anyone who has anything to say, let me know. We might change it next year, but that's one of the things we do with the funds that we get. We're totally volunteer, and we just fundraise and do whatever we can. So in the presentations, we also do an evaluation. And on the evaluation, we ask them questions like, was this presentation helpful? How was it helpful? And all that sort of stuff. I think maybe, Nancy, you helped me with it at one time. But anyway, there's one question on the evaluation that asks, do you know anybody that may be suffering from depression or that you think might be suicidal? And most of the time they say no. But occasionally we get one or two that will say yes. And so we always make sure that there's a counselor around. I tend not to do the presentations on a Friday because it's close to the weekend. Then they might not be able to find someone to talk to. But on one occasion, it really sticks in my mind, it was a private school, the name of which I won't mention. We went there, and afterwards, these evaluations, I will skim through them right after this to see if there's any problem. And they said, yes, they were worried about this person. So I think we managed to get hold, someone recognized the writing. We got hold of a couple of the girls who we thought had written this. And it took us, the counselor and myself, over an hour to get these girls to tell us the name of the person they were worried about. They were worried she'd be cross with them. And we said, but wouldn't you rather she was cross with you and she was alive than she killed herself? So just trying to get that through to them was so difficult. You know, I can't quite understand it. Why they just could not give us her name. We did get it out of them in the end, and of course the counselor saw the girl and got us some help. But it was just unbelievable to me that it was so difficult. People talk about closure. From my experience, there isn't any when you lose a child, especially in this way. and maybe that's true, losing a child in any way. But I would say that you just learn to live with it, and you do what you can to keep going, especially in the early years. And things get better, but you never get over it. So if we can prevent it, it's great. And I think we are doing more and more, especially since the bullying. What's her name?
Amanda Todd.
I think a lot more has come out since then, you know. And the schools are more willing to talk about it. You'll always find people who, for various reasons, it's a taboo, and it's, you know, there's the religious taboos, and but. What else? The planning, in our presentation we talk about the whole planning thing and, talking to someone, finding a responsible adult, or going to the hospital, phoning 911 in the crisis line. So that's all that. And on our orange bracelet, as well as the 1-800 number, is the Youth in BC website. We have a website, of course, and that has all the myths and what to do and resource numbers and all that sort of thing. I think that's probably about it.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so last but not least, certainly not least, is Brent Seal. Brent is a nationally recognized mental health and wellness expert and the founder of Seal Wellness, a social enterprise created to support students and young professionals to turn their challenges into opportunities and live great lives through wellness. While studying in university, Brent experienced serious mental health challenges, which led him to sharing his story around British Columbia and across Canada, graduate from his SFU business class as valedictorian, and start running ultramarathons. So welcome, Brent. Go ahead.
Thank you. So I'm conscious of the time, so I'm just going to try to flow off a few of the ideas that have been shared here already from the other presenters and just quickly share a bit of my story and hopefully give some tips that can be helpful. So as Dr. Black said, suicide attempts, suicide can really happen to anybody. That was certainly the case in my experience. I was a happy child growing up, playing a lot of sports, had friends, was performing in sports at a high level, and ended up at the same time getting into partying and kind of smoking pot and drinking. And on the outside, you could see success and happiness, but on the inside, there was that inner struggle that really wasn't recognized too much or dealt with too much. I want to talk about how recognizing that those signs early on can make such a difference. I mentioned some suicidality quite early on to a number of people. It wasn't really acted on too much. I ended up quitting hockey, going to Whistler for a couple of years, partying for a while, transferring into university after realizing my career wasn't going to take off in Whistler, and trying to switch over from kind of party guy to active, engaged student, and quit smoking pot, quit partying, cold turkey, isolated myself because of that, because I didn't know who I was all of a sudden. Obviously, there's chemical reactions going on in the brain that cause stress, and later episode of psychosis, then a relapse. During the relapse, it was much worse. It involved a suicide attempt because I just thought the whole world was coming to an end. I thought I was going to die in horrible ways at any moment. And really, that's another key point, is access to means to die by suicide is really important. If I had a button I could have pushed, for a number of weeks, I would have pushed that button as soon as I could. I was trying to think of ways to die, and just it's really a challenging thing to do. And luckily for that, I got into the hospital and got some support, and even though I had a suicide attempt. And for a while, I got in the EPI program, the Early Psychosis Intervention Program, an amazing program, had amazing family support, school support, medication fortunately worked for me. For a couple of years, I focused on mental health and mental wellness, learning about stress management, relapse prevention, learning about psychosis, learning about schizophrenia, which I was diagnosed with. And after that, I started switching my focus to just more wellness in general, because I realize mental health, mental wellness alone is not enough if you don't have physical wellness, nutritional wellness, relationship wellness. So I started broadening my search for answers in those areas. And that kind of flowed me more upstream as well in my work with others. I started volunteering and working in the field. I worked here as a youth in residence for 3 years, and now I'm on my own doing doing more training and speaking and working on projects. And the prevention piece is really, really important to me as well, because I think a big thing about the stigma, I really don't think focusing on stigma is that productive. I think we got to focus on branding in mental health. Mental health is branded so poorly. I study business in school, so I kind of come from that business perspective. But branding is really important. And I want, when I go into a training in school, I want the students to tell their friends that it was cool, that it was fun, that it was exciting, that they learned. I don't want them to hide it from their friends, the fact that they came to that program or training. And so one of the training programs I'm setting up in schools for next year, I'm going to call it The Edge. Nothing to do with mental health or wellness, but it's about high-performance wellness, and you slip in the mental health awareness training. You call it The Edge. It's the competitive edge, the mental edge, the edge against stress and challenges that you can provide through training while sneaking in that mental health awareness and suicide prevention training. And I, speaking with students, they like that terminology because that's something they can tell their friends about and not have that stigma around it. So it's attacking the stigma, but with a different approach. And that's sort of what I'm trying to do. I think it's a good approach. In my own recovery, I realized very early on that medication and therapy were often needed, but never enough. So that was the approach to set up a support system, find friends that I could trust and rely on in good times and bad, build my nutritional profile and just getting the nutrients my brain and body needs to not feel stressed, to really repair the brain from a nutritional standpoint, getting exercise, all these kind of key factors that are more upstream, but that's the preventative approach, I think, that really has helped. And it's been 7+ years, no suicide attempts, no hospitalizations, no major relapses, and it seems to work. But it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of support. I realize I was very fortunate in best case scenario in a lot of areas of the fact that the medication would work right away, the mental health team I had, the family support, the school support, and that's why I work in the field to try to help others, because I just have that duty to help and give back. But really, it was a lot of luck in a lot of ways as well that I got through those years. But some of the other things that work, one of the things is I call it my wellness toolbox. So I sometimes experience symptoms and mini relapses or little blips of symptoms, and I just call it my wellness toolbox to help me through those times. So that could be a bit of extra medication for a few days, talking to someone I trust, my girlfriend, family, mental health team, friend, talking about what I'm going through, clearing my schedule for a few days. I've been flown into symptoms at 10 p.m. on a Friday night and cancel a speech at 10 a.m. Saturday morning because of a relapse prevention protocol that I just set up for myself. I just said, I can't go on that stage, and I have to do this for me, and that's helped me keep well. Other things in the wellness toolbox are, again, the regular exercise, positive coping tools. I think a lot of people fall into negative coping tools, and really focusing on replacing those negative coping tools with positive ones really helps. And so I know we're pretty much out of time, so I'll just leave it at that. If you have any questions afterwards, happy to chat with you one-on-one.
Thanks for sharing, Brent. Any questions?
Just the different foundations and spellings of things. So yours... versus Seal?
Seal, just like the animal. It's like my last name. Yeah. SealWellness.com.
Yeah. I saw your... And it was YouthMBC?
YouthMBC.com.
Yeah. Anyone else in the room have any questions or comments? Okay, I think that's it.
Thanks, everyone.
Great, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.